Welcome to Torah Macha, Nachyomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Rena Foreman, and today we will be studying Yechezkel, Perek Lamed Aleph, Chapter 31. When we think of God, many times we refer to him as Melech Malchei HaMelachim, the King of King of Kings. It sounds a little repetitive, right? Why not just say that God is King of Kings? What does King of Kings really mean? This is a term coined for God by Chazal, and perhaps it has roots as a response to this age that Yechezkel and the Nevi'im Acharonim were living in. It has roots in the beginning of the period of history we now know as the Age of Empires. Before the Age of Empires, the world had kings, but those kings were regional powers. They were the heads sometimes of city-states or of their own indigenous populations. But in the Age of Empires, all that changed. Empires were created in which a dominant king would capture many other nations, extending their dominance as far as possible throughout the civilized world. The emperor was something new. He wasn't just a king. He was a king of kings. And to this day, the tombstone of Koresh, Cyrus the Great, actually has that motto emblazoned on it. His tombstone reads, very simply, King of Kings. Maybe the term Melech Malchei HaMelachim was Chazal's way of responding to this new historical era, the Age of Empires. We needed to make sure we differentiate God from the earthly kings of the time period, who thought of themselves as all-powerful, as the ultimate power in the world, as King of Kings. God, Chazal remind us, is above those empire-sinking kings, Melechei HaMelachim, Kings of Kings. He is Melech Malchei HaMelachim, the King of the Kings of Kings. Historically, the Age of Empires began with Ashur, Assyria. It was the first great empire, with its capital city of Nineveh, familiar to us from the story of Yonah. Ashur conquered the 10 tribes of Israel in the years before Yechezkel came on the scene, exiling them from their homeland. It reached similar destruction with forced exiles elsewhere in the civilized world as well. But by Yechezkel's time, Ashur had fallen, and King Nebuchadnezzar became the next great emperor on the world scene. In Yechezkel's lifetime, Nebuchadnezzar is in the process of amassing his empire, picking off one nation at a time. He is becoming a new king of kings, much to the dismay of other regional powers such as Mitzrayim. At this moment, Nebuchadnezzar had her eye on Israel and had created a matzor, a siege, around Yerushalayim. Our perek portrays Mitzrayim in relation to all of these events. She, Egypt, would love to see herself as a similar contender for world domination. She has illusions of grandeur. She thinks she is in the running to be Ashur's heir, to create a great empire of her own. But God sees things differently. God sees Mitzrayim for what she is. A mishenet kaneh, a wobbly reed that does not offer real support. Egypt makes gestures of collaboration with other regional powers, including Malchut Yehuda, in her attempt to possibly unseat Nebuchadnezzar. And, in desperation, Zedekiyahu, king of Yehuda, buys the fantasy. He becomes subject to the illusion that Mitzrayim will save Yerushalayim from the long shadow of Nebuchadnezzar. But, true to Yirmiyahu's nevuah, right around now, Egypt does in fact become undependable. She retreats, reneging on her implicit promise of hope to Yerushalayim, leaving her powerless to withstand Nebuchadnezzar's siege. Yirmiyahu had warned that these events were not the random workings of history. No, Nebuchadnezzar had become an agent of the divine. He was to be the next King of Kings. In line with this, you might recall that back in the Prakim describing Zor's demise, God himself had called Nebuchadnezzar Melech Malachim. Hineni mevi el Zor Nebuchadnezzar Melech Bavel mitzafon Melech Malachim. I will bring against Zor Nebuchadnezzar, King of Bavel, from the north, the King of Kings. The last Prakim had begun to state God's response to Mitzrayim's attempts to gain power. We heard there that God will break, or more accurately, let the arms of Paro fall and strengthen the arms of Nebuchadnezzar. He will scatter Egypt and allow Bavel to rule. The message was clear. It is now Nebuchadnezzar's time, and it is time for Mitzrayim to recede into the background. In our parak, the Navi will continue with these themes. Yechezkel will convey a message of the demise of Mitzrayim using a mashal within a mashal. The parak begins with God addressing Paro and his nation, asking him, Who do you think you are? Meaning, do you think you're so great as to compare yourself to a true superpower? The psukim go on to detail who the superpower is that Mitzrayim might compare itself to. It is the last great empire to have reigned on the world stage. Hine Ashur, Erez Bilvanon. Behold, Ashur is like a cedar in Lebanon. Mitzrayim compares itself to Ashur, which is in turn, in the Navi's eyes, compared to a cedar tree, and Erez Bilvanon, a mashal within a mashal. What do we learn about this tree which Yechezkel compares Ashur to? The psukim go on to tell us the tree was beautiful. It was called Yefei Anaf. It provided shade, Choresh Mitzel. It was tall and mighty, Gevah Koma. The psukim then go on to talk about the source of all this power. Where does the tree get its might from? It goes on to attribute the power and beauty of this great tree to the rivers that are her water source. Toho Mormamatu, water made it great. Et Naroteha Holech Svivo Mata'a, the depths raised it up. Its rivers went around its roots. Vetaloteha Shelcha, and its channels continued. And, truthfully, Ashur really was powerful because of her water sources. It was situated between Prat and Chidekel, the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in ancient Mesopotamia. In fact, the word Mesopotamia itself actually means between the rivers. Meso, meaning between or in the middle of, and Potamos, meaning river. Her economic power came from the rich, fertile land, irrigated naturally by these mighty rivers. In the next psukim, Chet through Yud Aleph, we hear more about this mighty cedar tree that is Ashur. And as we listen, we will begin to pick up some familiar imagery. Arizim lo amamuhu, began Elokim. Broshim lo damu, el sapotav. Va'armonim lo hayu, kiforotav. Kol eitz, began Elokim, lo dama elav b'yofio. Cedars in God's garden couldn't cover it. Cypresses could not compare to its branches. Chestnuts were not as fruitful. All the trees in God's garden were not as beautiful. Yafe asitiv berov daliotav vayekan uhu kol atzei eden asher began ha'elokim. I made it beautiful, such that the other trees of Eden in God's garden were jealous of it. Yes, of course, it's hard to miss. The lush surroundings of this tree evoke the imagery of Gan Eden. Even the rivers we heard about in the last section are reminiscent of the four rivers that came out of Gan Eden. V'nahar yotzei me'eden lashkot et hagan. In Bereshit, we read that the river left Eden to water the garden, and from there it separated into four branches. The Navi even uses the words Gan Elokim to describe Asher's geographical location. No tree in Gan Elokim was as beautiful as this tree in the Gan Elokim. It sounds like this tree had great potential to do many wonderful things for the world, but alas, her powerful position among the other trees led this tree to mistake the meaning and purpose of her might. She became haughty, for Ram levavo begavho. Lachain kol mar Hashem Elokim, yaan asher gavat bekoma, vayitain tzamarato al bein avotim, for Ram levavo begavho. Therefore, Hashem says, because you were so tall and pushed your upper branches into the canopy and became haughty because of your height, for etnehu beyad el goyim, so I chose to give you into the hand of the strong among the nations who would do with you as he liked. I cast you out. So because of her haughtiness, Ashur was chased out of the garden, so to speak, just as Adam and Chava were once chased out of Gan Eden. It is even the same word, geresh, that is used to describe the expulsion from the Gan in both cases. In the next psukim, Yud Bet through Yud Daled, we learn more about the downfall of the cedar tree. We learn that Arizei Goyim, cruel nations, cut off this tree and scattered its fallen branches, leaving them forsaken on mountains and hills. And then the birds and animals take advantage of the fallen tree, now in its fallen state, rather than standing proud. Amapalto Ishkenu Kol Of Hashamayim, Ve'el Parotav Hayu Kol Chaya Hasadeh. The birds of the tree will roost on it once it's fallen, and the animals of the field will come among its branches. These creatures, we heard about them first in the story of creation, Of Hashamayim and Chayat HaSadeh. These were the birds and animals that once delighted with Adam and Chava in Gan Eden. Now, The king is dead, but the birds and animals persist, finding refuge among her fallen branches. And according to the Psukim, there is a lesson in this fall of the great cedar tree. It is all meant to teach something. Laman asher lo yigbehu bekomatam kol atzemayim. It was meant to serve as a lesson to the other water-lining trees that they shouldn't become haughty as the cedar tree did. The fall of Ashur, the first great king of kings, echoes the fall of another king many centuries earlier. Adam was charged with a mission. Vikipshuha, conquer the world. Use your might to dominate the animals and the birds and all of the living creatures. Adam was, by rights, the first great king of all creatures, the first great emperor, ruling not over diverse human populations, but over diverse animal populations, over all living creatures of the world. And both Adam and Ashur didn't occupy their positions by chance. Both were fulfilling a divine mandate. Adam was told, Vikipshuha, and Ashur, according to Yechezkel, was likewise God's agent in dominating the world. But then something happened. Ultimately, both were expelled from their respective gan, from their respective gardens. Why? The answer is nearly the same in each case. Arrogance interfered with the way that great power should have properly been deployed. For Ram Levavo Bekavho, Ashur, that cedar tree, he became haughty due to his height. Ram Levavo. Those words actually contain an echo that bring us back to another place in Chumash that speaks of kings. These words echo Sefer Devarim, which gives a list of crucial words a king is meant to obey. He isn't to take too many horses or too many wives. He is not to amass too much gold and silver. And he is meant to write a Sefer Torah for himself to accompany him at all times. Why? Because the power of a king is a dangerous thing. It is like a mind-altering drug, if you might. And the king needs to counter the effects of that, not to get carried away with it. And the Pesukim and Devarim tell us, L'man yelmad li'ir'at Hashem elokav, lishmor et kol divrei HaTorah hazot, ve'et chukim ha'eleh la'asotam, in order to learn to fear Hashem, to keep the Torah and the mitzvot, levilti rum levavo me'echav, so that his heart does not grow haughty over his brothers. Levilti sorben a mitzvah yamin u'smol, so that he doesn't stray to the right or left. And what happens if a king obeys these rules? These rules are the key to a long reign. When it comes to kingship, haughtiness is the real hazard of the job. A king is meant ultimately to serve the people. In the end, he is not better than they. He is meant to use his power to better the lives of his subjects. But it's easy to let the power get to your head. And if you do, then instead of using your power to benevolently care for the people, you end up abusing that power. If, as a ruler, you become power hungry, then your subjects will learn from you what matters. They will learn to crave power too, and you will evoke their jealousy. Others will want that power too, which is what happens to the cedar tree, to Ashur. She abuses her power, thinks of herself as a god, evoking the jealousy of the other trees, and gets herself thrown out of the garden. In the story of Gan Eden, something similar happens. Adam eats from the tree because he and Chava are entranced by the power they might achieve. As the Nachash says when tempting them, Ve'yitim kelokim yodei tov v'ra. Once you know good and evil, you'll be just like God. God tells Ashur, you thought the power was yours to do as you like with, but you, like Adam before you, mistook your purpose. And like Adam, and like the king in Sefer Devarim, you'll find that you are not immortal. Ashur, like Adam before him, ultimately dies rather than reign forever. Death is our reminder that one is truly human, not supernatural. In the end, you're not Elohim. You, Ashur, are not the ultimate power in the universe. And therefore, like Adam, you will be expelled from the garden, never to return. In the final psukim of our parag, we hear that once Ashur goes to its grave, Vayinachamu be'eretz tachti, kol atzei Eden, mivchar v'tov levanon, kol shotei mayim. And then the trees of Eden, who were previously jealous of the Ashur tree, will be comforted when it is destroyed. Interestingly, in the aftermath of Gan Eden, we also have that same phrase, Vayinachem. And there too, it is associated with destruction. Because after God expels Adam and Eve from the garden, he eventually regrets creating man. V'yinachem Hashem ki asa et ha'adam ba'aretz v'yitzev tzeva libo. God is saddened by the deeds of man and contemplates destroying them, saying, ki nichamti ki asitim. I regret that I made them. At the end of the parak, we circle back to Mitzrayim. If you remember, all this was an extended mashal. But the point was that Mitzrayim might, in its fantasies, see itself as the next Ashur. Why? Well, Ashur was a regional power that rose to world dominance, and its topography is in a way similar to that of Mitzrayim. They are both blessed with rivers that nourish them and provide them unusual fertility and economic stability. Egypt, too, is like the Gan of Hashem, as the Torah once said about Egypt when Avram parted from Lot. Sodom was Kegan Hashem, Ke'eretz Mitzrayim. As for Egypt, the Nile, of course, is its source of power, so much so that Paro, although he is a lesser power, he still falls into the same trap Ashur did. He gloats about his own godliness. He says, Li Hayaor V'ani Asitiv. I have created the Nile. The Nile is what matters. In the final pasuk of our parak, it becomes clear that the expulsion and destruction of Ashur is meant to be a lesson to Mitzrayim, who is vying for power at this point. The message from God here is, Paro, do you really see yourself as better than Ashur? Be warned by what happened to them. You'll end up falling just as they did. Ashur at least had reason to be haughty. She actually was a superpower. But you, Mitzrayim, you don't even have reason to be haughty. You are a minor power. And yet, you are still infatuated by dreams of domination. As we will see in the next parak, God will teach Paro, you may be a tanin, a great crocodile, but you are limited as a sea creature. Your power doesn't extend beyond the river. You can't really go beyond the boundaries of the Nile. Your dreams of empire will fade. It's Nebuchadnezzar who will be the Melech Melechim for now. Of course, readers of Tanakh know that the tables will turn yet again. For of course, empires only last so long as God wills them to. And in fact, believe it or not, the story of the haughty tree in our parak in Yechezkel, it repeats itself again in Sefer Daniel. There, the Navi uses the same metaphor, signaling that Babel will fall, and a new empire, the third great empire in this age of empires, will take its place. That new empire was Persia, Paras. In the fourth parak of Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar tells Daniel about a dream in which he sees a mighty tree, taller than everything else, which provided shade and food for animals and birds. The tree is then cut down with a stump left in the ground. Daniel explains that the dream is a message for Nebuchadnezzar himself. He has become mighty, but too proud. He has attributed his greatness to himself, and so he too will be made to understand that he is only human. As the Navi in our parak says, the fall of Ashur, and by extension, the fates of all these empires and all those, like Egypt, who are similarly tempted by the dreams of ultimate power, the humbling of all these nations serve as lessons. Ultimately, there is only one Melech, Malchei HaMelachim, and that is God Himself. Thank you for studying together, Li'ilui Nishmat, Riva Schwab, Rivka Bat Alexander Sunder.